You are now listening to the Someone's Favorite Productions podcast network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to New World Pictures podcast bonus episode. We have a great interview with another person who worked at New World Pictures. I hope you're excited. We are. I'm Ryan. With me, as always, is Mark.
Is this your interview with me?
Nope. No, not with you. And Erica.
Oh. It must be the interview with me then.
Nope. Neither of you two. Oh, in fact, both of you were there. We're talking to editor Alan Tamayan, who worked at New World Pictures, doing a lot of trailer editing, but also was one of the main editors for director Paul Bartel. Not Death Race 2000, but once he sort of went away from New World, he was the editor for most of his movies, basically, during Paul Bartel's directorial, including Eating Raoul. And we'll talk a lot about that. We are going to talk about also Lust in the Dust, which he also edited and ended up becoming a New World movie once Roger Corman sold the company. But we're going to be talking to Alan about a whole bunch of things. He also worked at New World. He worked on Grand Theft Auto and Lady in Red and did some other things with New World before he became an editor. So we're going to talk to him about how he started out at New World, and then eventually became the main editor for Paul Bartel and all of those journeys that he had. It's a great interview. And I got to say, Alan Tamayan is one of the absolute nicest guys that we have ever spoken to. We were thrilled to interview him. And I have to say, I really want to give a shout out to Brian Sauer. He's the one who connected us with it. Friend of the show, Brian Sauer from
Thank you.
Pure Cinema podcast and Just the Discs. He's the one who hooked us up with Alan. And so we are very grateful to him. And grateful that we were able to talk to Alan Tamayan. Let's not waste any time. Let's get into it. Here is our conversation with Alan Tamayan.
Well, I graduated from the University of Bridgeport in Bridgeport, Connecticut in 1976 with a Bachelor of Fine Arts in Cinema. And I had two choices back then, to work in New York, which was very close to where I lived in New Jersey, or come to Hollywood. And I wanted to work in feature films. And I thought, well, that's the place to be, is in Hollywood. And so I, another friend of mine from school said, yeah, sure, I'd like to go to Hollywood as well. So the two of us just packed up, and I happened to have a cousin who lived out here. So I got in touch with her and said, can I come out? And she was married and had a family. And so she was very helpful in getting me situated, giving me housing, or both of us housing, for about a week until we could find an apartment in Hollywood, a one-bedroom furnished apartment with utilities for $147, I think it was, or maybe $145.
That's amazing. Can't get that anywhere close to that today.
Not at all.
No, not if you're renting a room.
It's true. So then I had to start making the rounds, and, you know, you just have these idealistic hopes that, oh boy, you know, I'm a graduate and I made movies in school and nobody cares. And one of my friends from college was nominated for a Student Academy Award, and he came out to California for the awards ceremony. And so I got to hang out with him and do some things. And one of the people in that group who was running it from the Academy was this man named Philip Chamberlain. And I got to know him a little bit. And I said, how do you get started? Nobody wants to take your calls. Nobody wants to interview me. He said, well, have you tried Roger Corman's New World Pictures? I said, no, where are they? He says, well, they're in Hollywood, on Hollywood's Sunset Strip. And Roger Corman's famous for giving young filmmakers a break for their first opportunities. So he gave me the name of John Davison, who is Roger's producer.
Right.
And I called John up and he said, sure, come on down. I'll talk to you. And I went and met him in a jacket and tie. And first thing he says is, what's with the jacket and tie? Don't you know this is New World Pictures? So I don't know. I was just trying to look respectful.
That's right.
Anyway, so he explained what they did and said, you know, we don't have anything shooting right at the moment that I can help you with, but I know someone who's starting a movie. And he said, I'll give you her name. And Let me give you a piece of advice. Be willing to work for free to get your first experience. So I said, okay, and went off and I called this woman. It was Terry Schwartz, who was a production manager for this movie called Bad Georgia Road with Gary Lockwood and Carol Lynley.
Gary Lockwood, burning up that bad Georgia road. Carol Lynley, a man-eater, a jet-setter, a no-stopping babe. She makes every move count.
And I said, John Davison gave me your name. I'd like to come on down and work with you. And she said, no, I'm sorry. We're all crewed up. We don't need any more people. I said, I'd be willing to work for free. Oh, okay. Come on down. And they asked me, do you have a car? I said, no, I don't have a car. So they said, all right, you can drive a motor home. And I was in charge of driving the motor home, which was used as the actor's dressing room. Bring it to the set every morning, stop in Winchell's Donuts and get coffee and donuts and keep the motor home clean and gassed. And that was it. I got my first job experience that way. And through that movie, I met a lot of people who had worked at New World Pictures. People like Michael Fennell, who was a producer of The Howling and many other of Joe
I
Dante's
think
movies.
Rock and Roll High School.
Yeah. And that was it. The ball just started rolling from there on.
You said you met people in New World. Does Bad Georgia Road then turn into Grand Theft Auto?
No, at first it went into some reshoots for some movies of Rogers. One notable one was Thunder and Lightning with
Okay.
Kate Jackson and David Carradine.
Yeah.
And they hired me for about a week of additional shooting. And I was supposed to help kind of like doing grip work or construction work. And we built catch ramps for the cars. They were just going to shoot stunts. And we
Okay.
went out to Port Hueneme on the beach. We set up this fake hamburger stand. Alan Arkush was directing these reshoots or
Okay.
pickup shots. It was his opportunity at that point. No, he had already done Hollywood Boulevard at that point. So yeah, I was just a production assistant and we did all things. Mike Fennell was producing the pickup shots
Okay.
and I got to know them. And through all those connections, I did some other jobs for Corman, like title testing. That was another popular
Sure.
young production
Could
assistant job.
so you
They
went
give
around with titles basically to the various high schools and asked people what title they
no.
would like more?
No, it
Because
would be on a Friday or Saturday night. They'd tell you to go to Westwood or Hollywood Boulevard, stand in front of the big theaters where there's a good movie showing. And while they're standing in line, ask people, show them these three different movie titles and say, based on the title, which movie would you prefer to see?
right.
And of course, they were just like movies that had blood or death or whatever in them. And most people would say, I wouldn't see any of those. But occasionally they'd go, oh, this one sounds more interesting. And you
Okay.
just take tallies of, put hash marks under the column of which
Right.
favorite one and note if it was a man, woman, age range. And then you tabulate that and give it back to them on Monday morning.
Were there any surprises? I mean, you're coming down with these different titles, and you thought this one will never fly, and then people liked it more than the others.
No, it was very forgettable work, really.
I
I
set you
don't,
up for that
I couldn't
one.
honestly tell you if any of those titles did get made. No recollection. I mean, that was a long time ago. I should have
Sure,
kept a
sure,
copy of them. Who
sure.
knew? Would have been funny to see what they actually became. And I
Sure.
do remember that there were some occasions where I would have a preference. So every once in a while, I'd put a couple of extra hash marks under that title.
Right.
That's good. So you eventually, though, do Eat My Dust. You went from Thunder and Lightning, which is, I think, that's a movie that Corman produced, I think, for Fox. And then you go to Eat My Dust, which is New
Well,
World
Grand
releases.
Theft Auto.
Sir, oh, Grand Theft Auto, pardon me.
Yeah, that was Ron's follow-up movie. He had
Yes,
already
right.
done Eat My Dust,
This
and
was his directorial debut.
he wanted to direct a movie. And Roger said, "Well, I don't know." You know, he says, "You still have to star in it. I'll let you direct as long as you star in it, and you have to write the movie." So Ron and his dad wrote the screenplay, and Ron starred in it, and it was a lot of fun. And so at that point, I had known the production managers and Mike Fennell and a bunch of other people, John Davison, obviously. And so I got hired on. And once again, I got to drive a motorhome since I became good at driving motorhomes. And I was Ron Howard's motorhome driver on that. And consequently, I was a production assistant on there. And there's one scene I was actually in the movie
Oh, really?
because, yeah, we were shooting this scene in Victorville. Most of the shoot was in Victorville for a few weeks out in the desert and all that. And there was this one scene, I don't know if you remember the movie at all, where people are chasing them in the Rolls-Royce to try to get the reward from the parents. And one guy, some crazy guy, throws a stick of dynamite in the trunk of a police car driven by a priest or so, a preacher, Bible thumping preacher. Anyway, and they're all chasing. So in this scene, in order to escape the roadblocks, and the Rolls-Royce decides to go up a construction ramp and go flying off and lands miraculously safe. And Ron was setting up the shot and clearing the street. And I said, "Ron, this doesn't look natural." I said, "It'd be great if you could have somebody sitting on the construction equipment. Why don't I go sit on the construction equipment? I'll put a hard hat on, and then when the Rolls flies off, I'll just go, 'Hey, what are you doing? What's the matter with you?'" And so he said, "Yeah, okay, that's pretty good." And then they told me, "Oh, well, then after we do that shot, then the police car follows and it explodes." But they said the trunk's just gonna pop open and there's just gonna be a little flame or something. I said, "Okay, that's great. I'll turn and I'll run and I'll jump off the thing." Of course, when they come to do I didn't get my cue. So I'm hearing the stuntman revving up the car and he's barreling it down the road to get the ramp. And I'm hearing this. And I go, "They should be saying something." So finally I turn around and go, "Holy shit, the thing's like right near the bottom of the ramp." And I turn and I jump off the thing, go flying through the air just as this thing's exploding into a glorious fireball. It looked great on the film. And anyway.
What, do you get stump pay for that or
No, I had to grab a shovel and put out fires in the person's lawn that we were parked next to. It was that kind of thing.
Did you get to
It's just,
interact much with Ron Howard during the production since you drove his RV?
it was pretty cool. I mean, we went to dinner with him and his wife Cheryl. His wife Cheryl was also a production assistant on the show, and the crew was revolting because they didn't like the caterer. So Cheryl graciously volunteered to prepare lunches for
That's right.
everybody. Anyway, it was a great time. We had a fun experience.
So does this lead to more of you driving RVs around? I mean,
A
basically.
little bit, yeah, I did because I was still kind of aimless. This was only 1977 when Grand Theft Auto. So I did a few of those things. And after a couple of years of this, I was just saying, I need to learn a craft. I can't just, become a director. You got to take a path. And people say
Right.
editing is a good path to directing. So, I said, "Well, okay, let me see. How do you get to be an assistant editor? I did stuff like that in college, but I don't have professional experience." So I called up Mike Fennell because I heard he was doing The Howling. And I said, "Hey, Mike, do you need help in the editing room?" And he says, "No, we've got our editor and our assistant. Thanks anyway." I said, "Well, I'll be willing to work for free." "Oh, okay, come on down." So
So this was
that's,
you going back to that, though. You had worked like a few times as a production assistant, so
oh
you
yeah.
have been paid, but you're going back
Oh
to now free work at this point.
Exactly. Yeah, I had worked, I don't know, I think on IMDb there's a list of all these forgettable movies that I
One
worked
was
on.
The Lady in Red, which was another
Oh
New World
yes,
movie.
yeah, with Lewis Teague. Yeah, that was a nightmare experience because it was during the second gasoline shortage or the gas and oil embargo. That was in 1979. And our main job was to keep the crew's vehicles gassed up because at the time they had odd and even license plate numbers, could get gas, and they were even restricting it to you can't buy more than $2 or $3 of gasoline at a time, which bought you more gas than you could today in a tank.
Yeah, that'd be next
Not
to
three
nothing at
quarters
this
of a
point.
tank. But anyway, so at that point, they rented a pickup truck and they bought a couple of 55-gallon drums and they bought some hand pumps. And we would try to go and bribe gas station owners late at night to fill up the tanks, with high test or regular. And our job was to just pump gas into the crew's cars and stuff like that. Fortunately, I got away from that. I said, this is a disaster waiting to happen.
It's not particularly also helpful, probably in the long run, in terms of wanting to make your own movies, which you were saying you were wanting to do initially.
Well,
And
initially, yeah, everybody has that ideal, like you'd want to come out and be a director or an actor or something. So I was in a large group that had ambitions.
sure. So
But
you go to the Howling, and you start. That's where
right.
you start working again for free. No pumping gas on this one. You're just you're assisting.
Kent Beta taught me everything. He taught me how to keep code numbers on the film and keep a code book and roll up trims and everything. And Mike thought I was useful. So after a week or two, they decided to pay me $100 a week. And I thought, wow, this is great. Okay.
And you worked also with Mark Goldblatt, right? Because he was the
Right.
editor.
Yeah. Mark and Joe were editing. And Paul Bartel was acting as Joe's interpreter for Pino Donaggio when it came to scoring the movie. So I got to meet Paul through that, and we were
Did
editing.
you hear much about the old, because you had a lot of New World people and you had also worked in New World. Was there any like, but this was not a New World movie. How the Howling
Right.
was in fact Joe Dante's first movie away from New World, though of
Right.
course he had tried to make the third Jaws movie
Yes.
prior to that. But
Well,
was there any like chatter about New World that you recall at the time?
the biggest chatter was that Roger passed on the script. He didn't want to do it. I don't remember why. Maybe he thought it was too expensive, or maybe he thought Joe needed to spread his wings and get out from under his tutelage. I don't remember the details, but anyway, it was a great experience. And then when Mark left that project, he did a Canon film called Enter the Ninja. He co-edited with another editor, Michael Duthie, and they each brought their own assistant. And Kent Beta went off to do something else. So Mark hired me as his assistant since he knew I was trained under T Kent and himself. And I did that, assisted him. And then from there, the next assisting job was for Kent Beta, who was cutting Saturday the 14th for Julie Korman.
I was wondering if Kent got you involved in that. Of course, Kent
Yeah.
also had started as an assistant as well, I think, back at Rock and Roll High School.
Right. Yeah.
So he had made his way up through the numbers. What did you said he taught you a whole lot of stuff. What else did he kind of teach you about, or what did you learn really from me, all those people, Joe Dante, Mark Goldblatt?
Well, I get to w see them editing and just see how the whole filmmaking process went on. One of the things Kent introduced me to was they had a fun, well, at the end of a reel, like when you go to mix the movie, do the audio mix, you would have to add, say, 30 feet of leader at the end of the roll to prevent the sound from unwinding in the recording, the mixing stage, because they line up dozens of reels of film, and I'm talking 35 millimeter mag stock. And so they're back and forth all the time. When they get near the end, you had to have at least 30 feet of extra film so that the film wouldn't run off the end and the time would be wasted rethreading everything. So we would do this for all the reels. And one of the things Kent said is, and we would get this old movie footage from the studios to use for sound fill. You just flip it over so the emulsion's away from the sound head. And a lot of times there'd be some interesting footage on there, and they'd be current movies that the studio was just doing a check print of. And then afterwards, they kind of throw it into a discard pile. But before, they would run a stripe through it, put a big scratch on the film. But we'd look at this stuff and go, hey, look, there's some great action. There'd be something of somebody shotgunning somebody in a room or something. And we'd find like a couple of seconds of great footage, and we'd put it on right after the two pop at, or not the two pop, but the tail pop at the end of the reel. So as the projector's running, you hear it goes through the last scene, and then I think it was 3 seconds later, there's a tail pop, boop, and then all this crazy footage would come on of something, and the projectionist would like, what the hell was that? You know, and so it got to be a running joke. We had 10 mo reels of the movie, and each reel would have a different gag ending, and they were always like, I can't wait to see what the joke footage is going to be at the end of this film, at this reel. So that was one of the big contributions Kent taught us. That
And
was
you
just a
worked on
pass of time.
Saturday the 14th. Did you get to interact and work a little bit with Julie Corman?
A little bit. Julie used to just come in and sit and work with the editors primarily. Didn't have to have too much interaction with the assistants. We were at the Corman Studios, the lumber yard in Venice, when we were cutting that. And they were shooting a Galaxy of Terror. Is that what it was called? Yeah, the
Galaxy of
one that
Terror.
James Cameron was the art director on. That was going on.
Now, you had been driving RVs and you'd been helping out with New World. Then you're working on The Howling, which was Embassy, which I guess they were having some financial challenges at the time. And then you jump over to working on Enter the Ninja, which is a Canon film. Did you notice any like obvious differences between the different production houses and like, oh, this one seems to be like a little, th this one seems to be a little more flush with money, a little more willing to do things versus the other, or anything that you recall of differences at the time?
Well, no, the only difference was Canon was a very frugal company, much like Roger Corman's company, where they kept all the costs down as much as possible. But I wasn't there long enough. It was just, oh, the other assistant editor and I, we got to do all the Foley work on the movie. That was kind of fun.
Yeah, that is fun.
Sho Kasugi was the
Was
martial
the was
artist
the
in there,
ninja, yeah.
and he came in and did a day's worth of Foley with us to just do all the sounds of his nunchucks, things like that. We'd record all that, and then we'd spend days cutting it all in together. It was a great experience. That I have to say about both Canon and New World, because of their frugality and unwillingness to hire people that they didn't need to. They would give young people the opportunity to learn by doing. And I mean, not only were we editors, but we actually got to be Foley artists. We did footsteps and all that kind of stuff, sound effects, and then were responsible for cutting them in. It was a great learning experience.
Which one was cheapest? Which one paid the least? Canon or New World?
Well, hard for me to judge because by that time, I was making real money as an assistant editor, but they were all pretty cheap at that time. Back then, I think maybe the going rate for an assistant editor was 250 a week or 300, something like that, which was fine by me because I was still living in that inexpensive apartment. It had probably gone up to about $175 a month by
Yikes.
then. So yeah.
Wow.
And so that led me to Paul Bartel's Eating Raoul, because I had heard through the grapevine that Paul was finishing this movie that he had been working on for almost a year on weekends with donated time and equipment from friends. And he had scraped enough money together from his savings and his parents to finish the movie. And he was going to do a 2 or 3 week shoot. And he needed an assistant editor. So I met him, and he was trying to do the editing himself and acting and directing. So we actually were using Joe Dante's offices, Joe and Michael's offices, where we had made the Howling. And
Okay.
this was in Hollywood, and it was they weren't charging Paul rent, I guess. He would just they had two big rooms, one for the producers and then one for the editing. So I got to be my own assistant on that. And then Paul gives me the dailies from the first day and says, after we screen them together, he says, "Why don't you try cutting this scene together next day?" I said, "Okay." So I put the scene together. It was a very simple scene. And the next night I'd show it to him, and he goes, "That's very good." He goes, "Okay, you're now the editor." And I said, "Oh, okay, great. So you're responsible for everything. No extra pay, but who cares? That doesn't matter." So I
Right.
was just my own assistant, and I'd roll up my own trims and work away. And
Did you know him very? I mean, you had met him before on The Howling, but how well did you know Paul Bartel at that point?
I didn't know him that well, no. It wasn't until we started working together on the Howling, I mean on the Eating Raoul, that I really got to know him. But I knew of Paul, obviously, from some of the old New World movies like Hollywood Boulevard. And even he was even on set for Lust, see, I was going to say Eat My Dust, no, Grand Theft Auto. He had a little
Right.
cameo part in
Right.
that. So I just got to meet him then too. But it wasn't until The Howling when we spent more time with him in the editing room and going to lunch together, that kind of stuff. So he was at least familiar with who I was, and
But you
at
hadn't spent a
least.
lot of time together, so this is really like your real introduction to him was really working
Yes,
on Eating Raoul.
exactly.
So what was your working relationship with him like?
It turned into a daily thing. He must have had me on payroll for the full length of it, which was probably at least another 6 to 8 months, because after we shot everything, we cut the film together, or I should say, we incorporated all the new footage into the existing footage, and then we'd have screenings for our friends. Paul was big on having screenings so we'd get audience reactions. What's funny? What's not working? What is working? How can we tighten things up? And it was just a process of screen trim, screen, re-edit, move things around. This scene's not working. Let's do away with that. And we just kept doing that for weeks. And then we got to the point where we had locked a cut, and it was a matter of getting it ready for the sound mix. And we had to do a lot of voiceover ADR work to fill in a lot of little missing dialogue points, plot points, and just background chatter for party people. So Paul set up a microphone, and we recorded at his apartment on Fountain Avenue. And we did a lot of that ourselves. As a matter of fact, there's a scene in the movie where I got to be in it. It's when Paul goes to the dominatrix's house to ask for her help. She's got a young boy, a little child, and he's watching TV. And there's a dog food commercial on the TV
Right.
for Doggy King Dog Food, which is the dog food company that Raoul is selling the bodies to. And anyway, the kid is watching this commercial on the TV, and there's a family at a dinner table, and they're sitting, mom, dad, two kids, and at the head of the table is this dog with a crown on his head, a guy in a dog suit. Well, that's me in the dog suit.
Oh my God.
And I forget what, and the Roger, pardon me, Paul's sister Wendy is the mom in that commercial,
Got it.
and she says, "Oh, Doggy King, this food is delicious, or something, I don't know." And I said, "And it's so good for you too, and then it goes into the song and just silly. It was a lot of that kind of stuff that it was just shoot and run and do it on your own. And
Now, you said though you had to incorporate the new footage because he brought you on. They had already shot footage. They've been shooting it off and on through like a whole year whenever they had the money and had funds together. Had he cut some stuff together already? Was there scenes already somewhat finished or?
He claims that he did. I really don't know if he did or if people like Joe Dante or maybe Alan helped him out and would put some scenes together for him. Because I never knew Paul to ever handle the film, really. So
But
maybe
it
he just
was, but
said
there
that.
was edited scenes that
There
you
were edited
already.
scenes, yes. And then we just sort of said, okay, well, these are the moments that go after this part. Yeah, he had filmed the opening scenes in the apartment building and the apartment itself to use that also as a fundraising tool to go around and show people, like, here's 5 minutes of this movie to give them an idea of what it's about to try to get money.
At that point, you guys must have gotten along very well because you work with him for several more movies. In fact, you went from that into Not for Publication, right?
Not for Publication, which was a pet project of his. He had done 15 years ago, and he shot that in Dallas. And then Lust in the Dust, The Long Shot with Tim Conway, and scenes from The Class Struggle in Beverly Hills.
Yeah, so like
Right?
basically through most of the movies he would direct at
Right.
that point. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a total of 5 movies. And in between all those movies, that's when I started doing trailers at New World Pictures
Right.
because Paul would get the financing and call me up and say, "Hey, I've got the financing. We're going to start another movie." "Okay, great." And I tell the people at New World, "Okay, I'm going to leave for a couple of months or whatever." And, "Okay, see you."
You told us earlier that the first one you did was for Stryker, and that was the first one. Now you said somebody hired you. Who hired you in? Was it Clark Henderson or was
Yes.
it okay?
Yes. It was Clark Henderson. And once again, they were working out of the lumber yard down in Venice because Roger had recently sold the company to these three investors. Before they had a place to go, Roger let them rent space at the lumber yard. And so that's where we started. But then after that, they moved to Raleigh Studios in Hollywood. And you heard the stories from Kevin Sewelson about
That's
that.
right, Dave Parker. Yeah, and then Lionsgate Studios, right? That was that's where they were. Is that were you in loca eventually located into that
Yes,
area
they are.
too?
And then from there, we went to Lionsgate on the west side.
And you were just down in that basement editing away and doing
Down in the basement, yeah.
And you did a couple trailers. You also did Escape 2000, which was also called Turkey Shoot, which
No,
is
I didn't do the trailer for that one. I worked on TV spots for
you
that
did
one,
TV
but
spot. Yeah, I
okay.
should sorry. I
That's
should
okay.
clarify. Yeah, the TV spot. But you were still kind of working with, and that was in that period where Roger had sold the company, so they were sort of just putting out these different movies that they would pick up.
Yeah, they
But you were just there, like whenever you, not a permanent basis at
I was
all,
not a
just.
permanent helper on that. I think those were the only two trailers that I worked on in that brief time period. Or those two movies. And then I probably went off to do another movie with Paul, either Not for Publication or, well, probably Not for Publication, because that was in later 1983, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah, that was in
Yeah.
83 that we shot that.
And
Yeah,
so you're.
we were at Raleigh Studios for several years, and we were under the direction at first of Clark Henderson, and then he left, and we worked with Tony Randall, no
Right.
relation to the actor. And then when Tony left, Jim Melkonian took over, and then at that point we moved to Lionsgate, but we were in Raleigh Studios for quite a while. I did Lust in the Dust there and a bunch of other movies like The Peanut Butter Solution and
You did the trailer for that, right?
yeah.
Yeah, that's a
So,
Canadian pickup.
and you did the
but
trailer for
the
one of our all-time favorites, A Certain Fury.
That was a TV spot campaign. Yeah, I
Oh,
didn't
okay.
actually do trailers on that one. Let's see, we did Breaking All the Rules at Raleigh, The Zoo Gang.
Got a poster for that right up here.
Really? I can't
Yep.
see it.
Yeah. It's all right. It's out of frame.
Anyway, yeah, those are some of the ones that I can remember from. Oh, and Making Contact, that was all at Raleigh Studios. And then
Yeah.
when we went over to Lionsgate, I did movies there like Hellraiser 1, Hellraiser 2, Heart, Death Before Dishonor, House 2, what else? Bunch of stuff.
The stuff that we've talked about it. We know
Yeah.
Heart, the boxing film.
Heart, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were trying to make that look like Raging Bull. We did it in slow-mo and tinted it a little bit bluish.
Tonight, Eddie Brennan has a ringside seat for the main event.
Can't keep losing $100 fights, Eddie. What the hell is left?
And that's young Steve Buscemi in that one.
Yes, it
Yeah.
is. Yeah.
But let's go back to Lust in the Dust. That was shot in Santa Fe, right? In New Mexico?
Correct. Yes.
Yeah. So is that where you edited it as well?
Yes. Yeah. We were staying in the Hilton Hotel. The whole crew was staying there, and they just rented another room or two for us to set up the editing room. And we had another room that my assistant editor, Mark Manos, would operate a projector. They rented a 35 millimeter dual system projector where you could interlock the film and the soundtrack. And so we could screen dailies at the hotel for the crew. But most of the crew didn't want to stick around after a 12-hour day and
Sure.
watch films into night. And then we'd go out to dinner with Paul because we had per diem, which was a blessing. You know, they give you $50 a day to spend on food. And
Yeah.
you just go, wow, this is great.
And then so you were there like throughout the production, right?
Yes, yeah, and my
Okay.
wife was there, or my future wife. She came out from Connecticut and was living with me. And it was when we went to Texas for the first one for not for publication. And I said, "Well, if you're going to come with us, you can't just sit around a hotel doing nothing. Let's put you to work." So we made her an apprentice editor, and they gave her, per diem, just to. As pay. And then
Wow.
by the time we did Lust in the Dust, we made her a full apprentice editor, and they gave her like $100 a week and per diem. And so we were doing great.
That's
Yeah.
great. Now, did you get to go visit the set at all in Lust of the Dust, or were you just
Not,
at the
no.
Hilton?
Yeah, we were just pretty much at the Hilton, locked in there, forced to work all day. I seem to recall that we might have gone to some locations once or twice, but for the most part, we were locked in the hotel working away.
Now,
And
when Paul Bartel talked about Lust in the Dust, he said he kind of wanted to make a movie with Divine being in a Sam Peckinpah movie. But the thing about Lust in the Dust that I really like is I kind of like that it seems a parody of like Westerns, American Westerns, but also a parody of Italian Westerns as well. Was there like any, did you have any, like, were there any movies that you were sort of drawing inspiration for when you were working on it?
Well, certainly a lot of the Sergio Leone movies, like we tried as best we could to develop some tension with close-ups and but sometimes the material wasn't always there and we'd do whatever we could to give it that feel. I
Sure.
think in hindsight, our biggest regret was that the script wasn't funny enough. There just weren't a whole lot of outward jokes in the movie. It's kind of quirky, and that was one of the things Paul and Tab Hunter were always kind of butting heads. Paul wanted to make things more quirky, and Tab was trying to, no, this is my baby, this is my project. And
He was producing it as well as starring in it.
yes, yeah. So
Yeah.
And he obviously was the star of it and wanted to come across as a heroic figure and trying to, make a comedy. Anyway.
Were they doing that while you're trying to edit the
No.
movie? Okay.
Well, there were a few occasions, when they would make suggestions in the editing room and say, I don't like this. Could we do it this way? And, Paul was, always had his reasons why it wouldn't work. And, they had little frictions.
Now, how was it working with Paul? Like, did he have suggestions he would make and he would sort of sit there and watch you kind of put it together? Or did he leave you sort of free to kind of edit it as you saw fit and
He
knowing
was,
he
yeah.
had certain takes that he might like and then come in and watch it later? Or how did it work?
Well, during dailies, the next night when we'd be watching the dailies, he would always tell me, this is my favorite take, or I'd like to start with this shot, then go to this, or play it up to this point in the wide shot. And so I'd just be scribbling notes down, and those would give me general directions. But after that, it was like, he left me alone to put it together, and then we'd go through it, and then he'd say, all right, let's intercut this a little differently, or let's put a reaction shot from this character, and we'd do back and forth. But he was ideal to work with. He was very giving. He'd let you have free rein to do it the way you wanted. And then he'd come in and say, this is working or this isn't working well enough. Let's fix this up.
He had had some run-ins with Roger Corman. Maybe he sort of wanted to not have that be the situation, with you and the other people he worked with.
I don't know. We just never had any serious disagreements or butt heads. My job was to give him what he wanted, so I wasn't going to argue with him. It wasn't until, what was the movie? Scenes from the Class Struggle. Well, first of all, he was butting heads with Tim Conway on the long shot, because once again, that wasn't Paul's kind of humor. And here he's being hired to do Tim's movie. And Tim's producer on that, Lang Elliott, had also produced or directed even some of those Western comedies they did. Which I
The
think
Apple
he
Dumpling
did,
Gang.
yeah, that kind of stuff. And so Tim wanted Lang to direct, and Orion Studios said, no, we need somebody with a name. And for some reason, Mike Nichols was an executive producer on this movie, and he knew Paul, and he recommended Paul, and Paul got hired. And it was just oil and water with Tim Conway and Paul, and but I didn't. We didn't see a whole lot of headbutting. I mean, most of the time, I heard the stories were on set, where they would have disagreements, and Paul would do it Tim's way, and then he'd do a couple his way, and that sort of thing.
And this, we're talking about the long shot, just to be clear,
Yes,
right?
right. Yes.
My totally non sequitur side story. Just last weekend, my wife's uncle was telling all kinds of like stories about the long shot. About remember the scene when Tim Conway does this. Remember the scene when this happens in the long shot. I haven't seen the long shot, but I was after here. He was just so like loved that movie. Thought it was so hilarious. That I had written down, like, oh, I gotta go see, I gotta rent that or check it out when I have an opportunity. So once again, I'm being reminded that I need to watch The Long Shot.
Well, yeah, in fairness, I should probably watch it again too, because Paul really liked Ted Wass's character, and he was able to tell Ted to do what he wanted to do, because Tim didn't have, he was c concerned about him and his partners, Harvey Korman, and who was the other comedian in that one? I can't remember. Anyway, Ted Wass was Paul's baby. He really loved his character and gave him a lot more attention to him trying to resuscitate his pet goldfish when he falls out of the fishbowl and stuff like that. And I think Tim hated all that stuff.
Is
I
Jack
remember
Weston, is that the other person that you were
Jack
thinking?
Whiston. Yeah, that's who. And they were hilarious. The day that we got the dailies from Jonathan Winters. Oh my gosh, is he a character? This guy can just ad lib and tell jokes, and he had people in stitches. We thought there was a lot of funny stuff in that movie, like Tim wrestling with the toilet bowl. Even the scene with he's on the crossing the parking gate. In dailies, it was hilarious. Somehow, when we cut it together, it just sort of lost its innocence and its charm. I don't know what happened, but it just
Not
sort
to
of
my
all
wife's
fell
uncle.
apart. Yeah, I mean, there's a market for it, but we laughed hysterically at the dailies, and when we were even putting it together, it would just bring a smile to our face, and the movie just did not get any love.
To go back to Lust in the Dust for a second. There were a bunch of rumors that there was going to be a lot of like rock and roll stars that were going to show up as cameos. In fact, there was a supposedly Mick Jagger was going to show up and make a cameo there. Did you ever hear anything about that or
Nope, I never heard that one. Yeah.
Might have gone to set on that day if that happened.
Yeah. A lot
The
of stuff
only
happened.
thing I remember was that Tab wanted more of John Waters' characters in the movie. I forget who the woman that was who played the older barmaid. They wanted the same woman who was in
Polyester.
Polyester, and Paul wouldn't have that because Paul just insisted she can't act. No, she's not funny. I don't want her in there. And
That was the character of Big Ed, I believe, right?
yes, Big Ed, that's right. Thank you.
And so, yeah, and we talked to Courtney Gaines, who was in that movie, and he
Red
said he
Dick.
had, and he said he had a great time working on the movie. He had a very and a lot of compliments for Paul Bartel as well.
Yeah, everybody loved working with Paul. I mean, he was just such a generous, heart-loving, warm man, but just great guy.
And knew a lot of good places to eat in Santa Fe.
Oh yeah, and he would always say, "I know this great restaurant. Let's make sure we go there," you know. And of course, this was a Santa Fe, and everything closed at 9 o'clock, you know. So there were only a few restaurants that might have stayed open till 9:30 or maybe 10. So he would always try to rush through the dailies as quick as possible so we could go to one of the restaurants. And we were close. We were right near the square in town, and there were a lot of good restaurants, so we could just walk to some of them right from the hotel, which was a lot easier than getting in a car and driving some. That was before we had Waze or any kind of GPS.
You wouldn't get lost and be
Yeah.
driving around Santa Fe all night. Now the movie eventually they were Tab Hunter and his partner who also produced the movie was from Fox, and I think at some point in time Fox was potentially going to pick it up, but instead the movie goes to New World.
Right.
Do you remember like hearing about that when that happened
No,
or?
I was off the pro show by then, and I was back at New World Pictures cutting trailers, and then all of a sudden, what comes in the door but Lust in the Dust?
And
And I got to work on that, and I
you
said,
cut that trailer, right?
yeah.
The Old West has given us many legends of heroism, many tales of courage and valor. Now, thundering across the screen, comes the mightiest, most inspiring saga of all. Return with us to an era when men were men. A time when the law of the land was the lay of the land.
Anyone like to try again?
Lust in the Dust.
That was a lot of fun working on a trail. And I got to work with a hilarious producer named Nelson Lyon, who was a copywriter and producer. He was a writer on Saturday Night Live when John Belushi was on the show. And subsequently, he was with John Belushi the night he passed away. So there were a lot of times when he had to disappear and go to trial downtown LA. He was nervous as hell during that whole time period, but very funny guy.
He was a real character. The more we've talked to people that work there, like Nelson Lyon comes up quite a bit. Yeah. We talked to Tony Randall and he brought up Nelson Lyon. He did the whole Godzilla 1985 campaign and
Hell Comes to Frogtown.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if he wrote that, but he had to. If you ever saw the Hell Comes to Frogtown trailer, I can't tell you who cut it. I don't know, but it's brilliant. It's one of my favorite camp trailers.
In the future, after the big war, there will come a time to rebuild and a need for a new and special kind of soldier.
This man is carrying a loaded weapon.
Prepare to meet the next great American hero.
That's where you come in.
Are you serious?
His name is...
Hell. Sam Hell.
Never heard of you.
Yeah. When we talked to Kevin Soulson and Dave Parker, Dave was telling us that Nelson would write copy like, this movie sucks. And that was his kind of idea, was like, this movie sucks. Just come see it. That's kind of the attitude he had.
Yeah.
And that worked great for New World at that time, but not so good other places, apparently.
Right. Well, he came up with the tagline on Breaking All the Rules, the screwballingest comedy of the year. Just anything where you could put some kind of sexual innuendo, he would go for that.
Right.
When I was working at Cimarron as a trailer editor afterwards, Nelson would always call me up and say, hey, can you get me a job over at Cimarron? And I'd try, and they would hire him to write some scripts on occasion. And they would complain that these scripts, we can't do anything with them. They're just so off the wall. They didn't know what. And they would hire him for comedies, too. And, like, I think we hired him for that Toys, the Robin Williams movie.
Right, right.
And he just came up with this outrageous stuff, and they just took one look at this and go, we can't cut this. The studio will kill us. You know, I kind of, but it was, you know, brilliant.
You also do edit a movie, A New World, sort of, because you worked on Making Contact.
Oh gosh. Yeah.
AKA Joey. And that is a pickup, Roland Emmerich's first movie, and they pick it up. But you were the one that re-edited it, right? Like, or no? Or you're just listed there as the editor?
Well, no, I started doing a re-edit with Marshall Drazen, the copywriter producer on the trailer for Making Contact, and we went through the approach of just trying to simplify the movie and make it clear. Well, apparently that wasn't enough for some people at New World, specifically Carl Colpert.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he took it over. So at that point, have at it. Well, they did a drastic recut on the movie, wrote new dialogue, new all kinds of stuff. And we were like, we have nothing to do with this. This is not what we were involved in. So that's all I can say about that.
Okay. Because, yeah, he and James Melkonian rewrote some different dialogue and different things to try to, like, make more sense of a movie that's very tricky to make.
But we thought they were just totally changing the movie. It was like, you know, the movie isn't that great. It's confusing.
Yeah.
But this, we didn't think this was making it any less confusing. I don't know. Marshall and I didn't have anything to do with it. So at that point.
Can you tell us, like, what they asked you to do initially, or what they tasked you with when you first started on it?
I think it was just to try to simplify it and explain it a little better. I don't remember what Marshall had come up with specifically copy wise and I think that's probably the problem. We were trying to keep the film more original to what Emmerich had done, because the movie has great production value. I mean,
right,
it, it's a loving tribute to Spielberg movies, notably E.T. and stuff like that, Poltergeist, E.T. But yeah, I don't know. We just didn't think it was right to completely redesign the whole movie. I don't think I've even seen the whole movie after they've been doing it. We saw little bits of what they were doing. It was like, oh, we're not involved in this anymore. Have fun. Do what you want on it.
And so you then do go back to working with Paul.
Oh yeah. Yeah, well, I don't remember what was after that. Probably not scenes from the class struggle in Beverly Hills, most likely. Because that was towards the end of our New World period. That was in 1988 that I worked on scenes from the class struggle. So yeah, up to there I had done movies like Under the Boardwalk and
Doing the trailers for
Patty.
those?
Well, I didn't do the trailer for that. I think Kevin may have cut that.
I think so. Yeah.
But I think another one of the editors at New World was Dan Gross. He worked on that as well. And I believe he was the editor of the feature film. I never bothered to look on IMDb if
Okay.
he was listed as the editor. I thought he was the editor. Anyway, so
So
I
you
didn't.
continue, but you did almost, did you almost work on the Eating Raoul sequel? Were you going to work
Oh,
on that if that had gone through?
That's right. Yeah, right at the end of Scenes from the Class Struggle, we started pre-production on Bland Ambition. Paul had financing commitments from Hemdale, was it? I don't remember.
Vestron, I think.
Vestron, that's true. Okay. And we started renting equipment, or at least putting orders in for equipment rental, and they were hiring crew people. We were in the same production offices, and then all of a sudden, the company went bankrupt, and they said, "Well, that's the end of that." And we went, "Oh no!" So had to cancel everything. It was sad. Never got made.
And
Would have been.
was it the script? You'd read the script, I take it?
Yes, yeah, the script was funny. Do you know anything about it?
It's them and they're trying to they're in politics and they adopt a child, I think,
Oh,
from I
yeah,
read a
well,
little blurb
that's
about it.
so Paul and Mary have the successful Country Kitchen, and it's a favorite night spot for politicians as well as actors, a la the way Jerry Brown used to go to Lucy's El Adobe in Hollywood, the Mexican restaurant. So the governor of California goes to their restaurant and has some kind of complaint with them and is outraged and upset at them. And Paul and Mary say, "Well, this guy is a jerk. You know, we could do better than them." And so they decide to run for governor, co-governors of California. And somebody suggests, in order to make a good family appearance, you should have a child. So they contact John Waters, who's in charge of an orphanage, and they say, "Have you got any kids that we can adopt for this role?" And he gives them their worst nightmare, this one problem child, 8-year-old girl who's so precocious, and he just wants to get rid of her. Hey, says, "You behave yourself, you know, go with these people." But then once she figures out why they needed her, she starts blackmailing them. And then Paul and Mary do the old Eating Raoul trick. They said, "This kid's driving us nuts. She's blackmailing us. What can we do?" They said, "Let's kill her." And Paul gets out the frying pan, and Mary says, "No, we can't do that." And basically, they stage an accident, like a car accident or something. They fake the kid's death. And outside of that, I don't remember how it ended or anything, but it's that kind of
Yeah, that's too.
mayhem.
That sounds awesome, and that's such a shame that that didn't get made. I know he passes shortly after that as well,
He
which
did manage to do Shelf Life, which I enjoyed. I didn't work on that because I was working at Cimarron at that point, but
Yeah, you had gone on to Trailers, but Shelf Life is a project with Jim Turner, Jim Turner's show, and Jim Turner was the lead in Grunt the Wrestling Movie for New World Pictures.
Yeah, I remember Paul telling me about it. He had seen a local play. It was a production in Los Angeles, and he loved it. He loved the cast, so he hired the whole cast and everybody involved with that and filmed it. And I thought it came across very well.
And
I
at that point,
enjoyed
you
it.
don't really edit any more features. You were just basically in trailers, right? Is that.
Right. Well, part of that was towards the end of Scenes from the Class Struggle, Paul had some falling out with the producers from Cinecom in New York. I don't remember. We never met these people. I never did. We would just send them cuts on a videotape and they would come back with these pages of notes. And Paul was just incensed at their suggestions. And he wrote this like 4-page response to each line item. Yes, we will try this, but it won't work, or this kind of thing, or you can't delete this scene because it does this and that. Oh, he was just so worked up. And consequently, they didn't really support the movie when it was finished and it came out. So it was kind of sad, but we had high hopes for the movie.
And at that point, that's when you were pretty much done also at New World. You heard, did, were you there up until the very end or?
No, I was gone, when I left for new for Class Struggle. There was nothing really to go back to because I think they were I think Mark Pierce was holding together a couple of things that they were still doing, but other than that, there was mostly television production for their TV shows
Right.
like Tour of Duty and whatever.
Wonder Years and
Wonder Years, yeah, they decided. Anyway, that whole experience that Paul had with those producers, it made me realize just how frustrating the director's life can be. And I just sort of lost interest in that. And by that time, I was married, we owned a home, we had our first child, and the last thing I needed to do was to be a struggling director. So I realized Trailers was quite a creative, fulfilling, a fulfilling creative outlet for me. And I just went on with that.
You're still doing that to this day, right? I mean,
Well, I retired this summer. So
oh,
I'm,
okay.
wow,
Well, congratulations.
congratulations. Thank you. Yeah, I turned 70 in May. So I just said, that's a good time,
Sure. Sure, but I think you worked, didn't you work on like Avatar 2? Like you've been working like up until very recently. Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I just won a Clio, a Gold Clio Award for
Oh,
this
wow.
piece, The Making of Prey, that
The Predator movie.
Predator movie that takes
Yeah,
place
congrats.
in
That's great.
Native Americans. Another editor, Tristan Canola? Oh, I can't remember. Tristan, anyway. He and I cut it together. We split it in half. I did the first half, he did the second half. Anyway, it was a lot of fun, and we were happy that it was well received.
Well, that's
But
wonderful. The congratulations. That, I mean, a remarkable
congratulations.
career. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Glad you go out with a big award. That's that you can't beat that.
It was fun working on the behind the scenes pieces because it was so different than Trailers. The company I was at, Mob Scene, they did a lot of behind the scenes work, and their producers would go out on location and interview everybody. They would photograph the production in process. So we would get all the footage and all the interviews, and the producers would piece storylines together and say, here, cut a piece about the making of the ghost effects in Ghostbusters, or about the re resurrection of the Ecto-1. So it was a lot of fun.
That's great. Now, just real quick, because before we wrap up, Just to look back at your time when you were in the trenches there at New World, just doing trailers in between productions, what is your prevailing memory of that time? Like, what when you think of that period of time, what do you think of?
Long hours. I used to joke with my wife. We had bought our first house, and we had been working on Hellraiser, it seemed, for months, because that was a big movie for them.
Sure.
And I joked that they paid for a couple of rooms in our house, for all the over the overtime and stuff like that on that. But yeah, it was the working with people. I made a lot of good friends with Dave Parker, Kevin Soulson, Jim Melkonian, and Dan Gross and Mark Pierce and the producers, Lee Stein, Marshall Drazen. We had a lot of fun. We were all working together in these. They told you that at Raleigh Studios, we had a big editing room with three or four moviolas all clattering away. You had to edit with headphones on, and there were one or two flatbeds that you could only use to build your soundtracks or your music tracks. The rest of the time, it was just a madhouse there, but we all got along, and it was a lot of fun. Good memories.
Now we ask this of everyone, so I'm not trying to put you in the spot, but when you do look and think back at your time at New World, did you start to see any shift of the company maybe sort of teetering towards not doing as well, basically?
Well, no, not really. We never really got involved in any of that stuff. The only thing we used to complain about openly to the management was when they did get a halfway decent movie, they would always give it to one of the professional trailer houses like Cimarron or Aspect Ratio. And we'd be like, oh, what about us? What are we doing here? And so occasionally they would let us cut a version just to humor us,
That's interesting.
yeah.
To have a whole group of people working on trailers and then not have you guys work on the trailer, that would be upsetting.
Well, because there was so much cachet that you go to these bigger trailer houses and they've got a reputation. Oh, they did this Spielberg movie or they did this comedy and they won that award and this. And, we're just the lowly in-house trailer company, but we're the guys that are there doing it all every day. But it was a fun time and we had a lot of freedom. And the head brass, they were in another building on Sepulveda Boulevard, so we were left to our own makings over there in the basement of Lionsgate.
Now, considering you've done so many trailers in your life, and what is like a pet peeve of yours when you watch a trailer? What is something that you when you see a trailer, you're like, oh, I can't stand that trailers are like this.
Well, I'd have to say it's giving too much of the movie away, telling too much. And that would be a complaint people would tell us all the time. They said, why do you give the ending away? Or why do you tell so much? And we say, it's not us. We're not doing it. It's the studios. They market test our trailers. They show them to audiences and they give them all these questionnaires. What was your favorite scene? What was your least favorite jokes? And they would come back and say things like, oh, I want to know more about it. Well, of course you want to know more about it. That's the idea of the trailer. You just show them enough to say, here, go see it yourself. But no, the studio would interpret that as, let's tell them more, show them more, put the best jokes in there. You can sometimes tell how bad a movie is if you see the same joke in every TV spot. It's like the one joke, the guy at the end runs and bounces off a glass door or something. If you see that happen, you go, oh boy, well, that's a sign.
Now, did it work? How it worked at New World is that they would assign like copywriters, as you were talking about, like Nelson Lyon or Straub Weissman or one of those guys. Now, as you moved away from New World, did that continue, or Were you always working with a writer, or were you getting more direct studio notes or producer notes?
No, it was mostly you were working creatively with a producer writer at the company. And at first, there was a lot more domination of narration to tell the story. That was easily through, the early and mid 90s. It wasn't until somewhere in the mid 90s, other trailer houses, you'd start to see things where there's no narration, or there would just be copy, but without a narrator reading the cards. And we would go, take note of that. You know, you don't have the see and say. I mean, when a narrator is explaining exactly what's happening, you try to get images that illustrate that. Now, all of a sudden, the studios are saying, yeah, let's do away with the narration, or much less narration. So now you have to figure out, let's find the parts of the movie that tell the story enough to give you an idea. Or you come up with a creative copy run that gives you a little, a trio of information that sort of tells you.
What's more fun to cut, if you have already a voiceover written and recorded that you have to cut to, or cutting something together when you don't have the voiceover?
Well, obviously, from a creative standpoint, it's a lot more creative and challenging when you don't have the crutch of narration. When you look at a trailer like Stryker, it's just wall-to-wall narration.
Yeah.
You almost have to laugh now when you watch a movie like that. You just go, wow, is there anything? There's like maybe three lines of dialogue in the whole trailer.
As well, Stryker doesn't talk much. As the narration.
You don't say much, do you? Yeah. People only want to hear what they want to hear.
And he really doesn't.
You don't talk much, do you?
People only listen to what they want to hear.
But that, what that doesn't spoil is, again, as we were saying, I think, before the recording, what that doesn't spoil is this baby coming out at the end and Stryker holding this baby aloft, which is not a part of the storyline that any of us were aware of.
Yeah, I don't remember that one. Yeah.
Real twist at the end on that one.
Real twist. Yeah. It's a real strange twist.
You know, the funny thing is, when you're breaking down a movie, everybody watches the movie once or twice. And then when it comes to breaking down, you're just looking for the good stuff that you can use in a trailer or in TV spots. Good images, good head turns. You know, that kind of stuff. Any action moments, people bursting into a room, dialogue lines, great moments. And so anything that's lot like that, you just pass over that scene completely. This scene is never going to be used for anything.
Right.
Except somewhere down the line, somebody says, we need to cut a female spot. And you go, really? You know, yes, we want to appeal to women. Well, this is a violent movie. Okay, all right, so let's try and tell it from the woman's side. So then you have to go back, watch the movie again, and say, oh, is there some scene in here that we ignored before that could be helpful for this now?
Was there a movie that you worked on, did a trailer, that you were like, oh man, I don't want to have to watch this again?
the Hours. I worked on a trailer for The Hours with, it was the three women in three different time periods.
Yep.
Oh, that was like one of the most depressing movies I've ever worked on.
It is. Yeah. That's a tough one to rewatch.
Yeah. And it was a Paramount movie, and they had like two or three or four trailer houses all cutting trailers because they couldn't really get the real feel of that movie from a marketing standpoint. I forget who, but they, at that point, they would also do things like, they would say, oh, we like this company's opening, but we like your back end. And they'll go to their favorite company. They'll say, give us all your materials. And they'll say, here, take this company's trailer from the back end and put it with your opening and that sort of stuff. And that was called Frankensteining. And we used to hate doing that. But then there was one more movie that was equally depressing. It was called House of Sand and Fog that I did a trailer for with Jennifer Connelly and Ben Kingsley.
I miss my dad. He worked really hard for that house.
It took him 30 years to pay it off.
The county has petitioned the court to reclaim this property. Now the house is up for auction tomorrow morning.
Auction? Are you out of your mind?
Oh my God, these movies are, they're so depressing. Anyway, I like happy movies.
Yeah,
like
sure. Comedies.
Like Striker.
Like action movies. That's probably easier because you could find more easily like the elements to bring out that you can put in a trailer and know you can try to bring some people into it. It's a little bit harder when it's just a real sad, movie with people talking to one another.
Yeah, and somehow you're trying to make this like you've got to go see this movie.
Get ready to get sad.
Yeah. So you hint at it, but you try not to. You don't want to know what's coming up here. Right.
So now that you're retired, are you thinking maybe of buying an RV and just kind of like whole full circle kind of with your career?
I was fortunate. I never damaged one, so I don't want to take my chances now.
Yeah, you got a perfect record. You don't want to ruin that.
Good record. Yeah.
Right.
Well, thank you, Alan. This has been great. Thank you so much. This has been so terrific. Thank you so much for all of your time. This was awesome. We really appreciate you.
Thank you for listening to it.
And that's it. That's our conversation with Alan Tamayan.
So great.
Such a great conversation. I mean, Paul Bartel is one of those people that when you see him on film, you just think that guy was probably just a really kind, cool person.
Yeah.
And it was great to talk with him about basically affirming what I just knew from watching him in movies that he really was a great, just a good guy.
Yeah. Yeah. And they got along really well and it just worked well together. I mean, it's amazing what Paul learned during his Corman years and then what he pushed further on. And, Alan, it was just great to kind of get a peek behind the doors and see kind of what those productions were like. And we hope you enjoyed this interview. We had a great time talking to Alan Tamayan. We hope you're going to be sticking around for this next month, Prison March 2, Second Offense. We're going to be talking about getting back into the Women in Prison movies that New World released. And so we hope you enjoy that. If you do, check out all of our episodes. You can go back and listen to all our interviews, our previous episodes, at our website, newworldpicturespodcast.com.
We've got some good ones in there.
We got some really good ones. Good. Got a lot really of good ones.
Including this one.
And we hope you'll go there. Check out our other episodes.
Not an interview.
That you can listen to our Tin Drum episode. Sorry, the Tin Drum episode.
Bang
And you can listen to our other interviews and stick around for an upcoming year of great stuff. We've got great interviews, great movies we're going to be talking about, all from New World Pictures. So we'll see you next time on the New World Pictures podcast, a part of Someone's Favorite Productions podcast network. Bye, everybody.